Hello, I'm David Eady. This is number 0178, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0178. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Joachim Esquelant, who is a former Montrealer who has opened a poutine restaurant in Munich, Germany. He's also getting ready to launch a poutine app game.
I thought I would love to have a game that involves poutine, and I had this weird dream or idea of poutine ingredients flying through the sky and a cool character running back and forth at the bottom picking up the ingredients. I got to know a number of the expats here that are in fact games developers. So I started talking to them and I found a partner who was going to help me develop this app as an iOS game, a game for handheld units and mobile phones. And so we're in the middle of developing that.
Frank Kermit is a relationship coach. He touches on many topics, including couples in transition.
Couples in transition refers to when a couple is making a significant change to their status. Now, this can include a number of things. It can include things like the emptiness syndrome. This can include a different stage where some of their children are old enough to be going to school. They no longer have an infant in diapers. This can also include when one person in the couple is interested in going back for an education and changing a career path. That's also a form of transition.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and this time Book Banter goes to the library and dusts off my ideal bookshelf. As well, I'll share some of the titles that make up my own ideal bookshelf. It's all due shortly on the Stuff File Program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0178, is one of my best friends on the planet, David Eady, financial advisor from the Wealth Management Group. And I thank you very much, David, for being the guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff. Okay, the usual 20,000 or so visitors every year to Belgium's Verbeek Foundation Art Park have the option, actually 365 of them anyway, to spend the night inside the feature attraction, a 20-foot-long, 6-foot-high polyester replica of a human colon created by Dutch designer Joop van Lieshout. Now, at one end, of course, another body part is replicated and gives the installation its formal name, the Hotel Cas Anus. Yes, that's the name. The facility, though cramped, according to one prominent review, features heating, shower, and double bed, and rents for the equivalent of about $150 a night. The 30-acre art park is regarded as one of Europe's edgiest art destinations. And I guess if you dare to stay in that room, you'll become the butt of all jokes. We have another religious wingnut alert. The issues director of the Fundamentalist American Family Association told his radio audience in November that God's feelings will be hurt if America stops using fossil fuels for energy. This is a quote. God has buried those treasures there because he loves to see us find them. Yeah, that's what Brian Fisher, who described Americans' campaign against fossil fuels as similar to the time when Fisher, at age 6, told a birthday present donor that he didn't like his gift, and it just crushed that person. Wow. Someone needs to adjust his medication. That's all I'm saying. Here's a quote from Captain Jeff Spencer of the Sauk County, Wisconsin Sheriff's Office. I love this quote. The deputies are familiar with her, recognize her vehicle, recognize her as the driver, and continue to stop her and issue citations. Yeah. The driver in question is Winona Rao Weirich, age 23, of Baraboo, and she has been given at least 33 citations for driving without a valid license, which is considered a minor infraction in that state. Thus, Winona can't be arrested as long as she keeps paying the fines. I never got my license, she admits. I'd love to get my license and get this whole thing taken care of. It hasn't happened yet. Bills are more important right now. Yeah, I'm guessing the most pressing of those bills must be the constant fines for her citations. And Ricky Hancock, age 51, was arrested in Clark County, Georgia, for armed robbery after allegedly stealing beer and a bottle of liquor from a woman at knife point. He was released on $10,000 bond and ordered to wear an ankle monitor. 7 months later, he was arrested on another felony charge after allegedly attacking another man with a tree branch. He was again released on $10,000 bond with an order to continue wearing the monitor. That all changed, though, when Hancock called his probation officer to inform him that he'd removed the ankle bracelet. When the probation officer and a police officer showed up to investigate, Hancock allegedly told them, quote, he had cut it off because it wouldn't stop beeping. Yeah. Hancock was very belligerent speaking, and he reeked of alcoholic beverages, the officer wrote. Hancock was booked on felony charges of second-degree criminal damage and interference with an electronic monitoring device. This time around, his bond has been revoked. So now I guess he just wants to stop the clanging of the cell doors. Yeah, it's all about the noise, isn't it? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's an ultimate story of irony. They are still trying to round up, charge, and try people for the hockey riots that took place in Vancouver a few years ago. Well, there's one person who has pleaded guilty to taking part. Sophie Laboisnière will be sentenced in May. Now, she was accused of being among fans who rioted after the Vancouver Canucks lost to the Boston Bruins in the 2011 Stanley Cup Final. Cars were set on fire and buildings looted as fans rampaged through the city after the 4-0 defeat. You all remember that, don't you? Anyway, Sophie, who was 20 at the time of the riots, did not appear at the provincial court in Vancouver. However, her lawyer entered a plea on her behalf and said that she would be present at the sentencing hearing. This is a quote from her lawyer, David Baker. She has received a level of notoriety that goes way beyond the offense she committed. She's stuck with that for a long time. Now, what notoriety, you ask? Well, that's where the irony comes in. Sophie was a contestant in the 2011 Miss Coastal Vancouver beauty pageant, and although she didn't win said beauty pageant, she was awarded the title of Miss Congeniality. A friendly type, I guess. Yeah, I keep telling you folks, I couldn't make this stuff up if I tried. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Jochen Esquilant is a former Montrealer living in Munich, Germany, but he is still sharing a little bit of Quebec with those around him. He has opened up an eatery that sells poutine. He also has a new app game that features the Quebec delicacy. Now, Jochen is on the line with us via Skype-to-Skype communication from Munich. Hi, Jochen.
Well, good evening.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
It's a pleasure.
So first of all, how does someone end up going to Munich, Germany and opening up a poutinerie?
Well, I had lived in Montreal for about 16 years and decided I wanted a bit of a change of pace and scenery. And my mother originally is from Munich, and I decided I'd like to come over here and have my daughter go to school here and learn German. And when I was sort of deciding what to do for a mid-career change, I decided that poutine was just about the most awesome food I could think of, and figured that the Europeans would love it.
So, now, you say career change. What was your career before this?
Before this, I had been in the property development business in Montreal and in the investment business. So a suit and a tie kind of guy, and decided that might be more fun to be standing behind a counter frying potatoes and serving up good gravies.
Okay, now I'm in Quebec. You're originally from here, so we know what poutine is. But for those listening in our worldwide audience, explain the delicacy that is poutine.
And delicacy is the right word. Poutine is a concoction made of French fries at the bottom, topped by some cheddar cheese curds, and hot gravy over the whole thing. And it was, according to legend, was invented in Quebec in the mid to late 1950s, where it was quite common, and still is, for Quebecers to be able to pick up at any corner store little cheese curds, Quebec cheddar cheese curds, which are a precursor, an early stage in the production of cheddar cheese. And they're sort of little nuggets, sort of the size typically of the tip of your thumb. And people could pick these up anywhere and have a little cheese snack when they would walk around. And the story goes that one day a truck driver had asked the guy behind the counter, who was preparing some French fries for him in a brown paper bag, to throw in the curds on top of his fries. And the owner of the cafe, the proprietor, is said to have exclaimed in French, "Ça va faire une maudite poutine," which means, loosely translated, "That's going to make one hellish mess." And so the delicacy apparently was born. And a little bit later, somebody apparently put some hot gravy on top of the whole mess, and you get this delicious mix with gooey, stringy cheese and hot gravies and potatoes. So
now, what made you think that this was something ripe for the European market?
The idea originally was actually to do it primarily in winter in ski resorts. And later on, thinking about it, even in summer, everybody eats potatoes. Europeans eat as many, if not more, potatoes than Canadians do. Everybody loves gravy, and everybody loves cheese. And to put them all together seemed to me something that one could translate quite easily. And I always had this idea that it was vaguely similar to pizza, in that you could have a starch of some sort on the bottom. You've got your carbohydrate. You've got a melting cheese that brings together this great mouthfeel and something gooey and delicious, and then any number of different toppings on it. And the idea that I had was to do, obviously, a traditional gravy as we'd get it in Quebec in most places, but then to put things on it like a Hungarian goulash or a Bavarian duck, roasted duck, or bolognese sauce, or any sort of different hot gravy. And I just figured everybody remembers what it was like when you used to eat at home or at grandma's place, and you'd get some potatoes at the end and put the gravy from your roast and whatnot all onto a fork and eat it up. And that wouldn't be delicious.
So what's it like in Germany? Do you get people coming in who know what poutine is before they try it? Is it an entirely foreign thing to them? Do you get many expats who go, "Oh, look, poutine in Germany"?
That's where it started. I got the expats involved, and there seems to be quite a strong connection between Germany and Canada for school exchanges and things, and student exchanges. And so I would get a lot of Canadian expats who would then bring friends and work colleagues, and people would find me on the internet who had maybe been to Quebec to study or been to University of Toronto or been at a high school out west, and they'd all somehow tried poutine once, and they tend to try and Google it when they're explaining it to their friends back here. And I'm basically the only poutinery that you can find in Europe at the moment.
I was about to say, it's not one business yet that's going to garner a lot of competition, is it?
The active word being yet. I have big hope, big plans for it. And it's very interesting. I moved over here about 3 years ago. I actually first moved to Austria. And for those people in Montreal, they may know of a place. There's a German-Austrian delicatessen and butchers on the corner of Queen Mary and Côte-de-Neige called Boucherie Atlantique. And I used to shop there a lot. And when we first moved over here, the one guy who works there, his brother, lives in Austria in a town called Bregenz. And there happens to be a Sacred Heart school there as well, related to the one in Munich. And I had gone to them, said, I have a daughter who would like to go to school here, doesn't speak a word of German. Would you take her? And so we moved there, and I used it as a base to go and do a bunch of different poutine events in different ski resorts. So I would go during World Cup skiing events and set up a tent, set up a thing, also in the summer at various different food festivals. And that's sort of how it started, getting people out there to try it. And it's tough, because especially the Germans and the Austrians are extremely traditional and extremely set in their ways, and they really don't experiment a lot with food.
Well, there has to be the added difficulty, I would assume, in that this is a career change for you. So it's not like you had a background in the culinary arts. You just decided this was what you're going to do. So there must have been a bit of a learning curve for you in that respect as well.
There was a learning curve. From a business point of view, I had looked into various different restaurant type projects back in Montreal. I am friends with a lot of restaurateurs, and also was a good customer of many restaurateurs in Montreal. And the time I really, really fell in love with poutine, because I'd actually lived in Montreal for about 12 or 13 years before I had my first poutine, funnily enough. And the first one I had was the one at Au Pied de Cochon, which is served with a foie gras on top of it, and has sort of become legendary in culinary circles. And it's where I took a bit of my inspiration from. And I asked around a lot. I spoke with a lot of people running restaurants and who had places in food courts at some of the malls in Montreal. And I sat and I talked to them and I asked about what all the issues were. So I tried to educate myself before I came here. And of course, I came here and everything turned out to be different.
Well, let me ask you this, because we have just about a little over a minute left. And I just want to find out, you also, as I said in the introduction, you have a new app game that features poutine. Explain that.
Yes. Right from day one, I thought I would love to have a game that involves poutine. And I had this weird dream or idea of poutine ingredients flying through the sky for whatever reason, and a cool character running back and forth at the bottom, picking up the ingredients. And so after a while, I got to know a number of the expats here that are, in fact, games developers. It's quite an active game development community here. And so I started talking to them, and I found a partner who would was going to help me develop this app as an iOS game, a game for handheld units and mobile phones. And so we're in the middle of developing that. And what we're going to try and do is get the development of the game partially funded using a method called crowdfunding, which seems to be a big buzzword at the moment. And we just launched the first information bit on Facebook a couple of days ago. And basically hoping to get this game both funded and then up onto the iTunes store and the Android store sometime within the next 2 to 3 months.
With all that you're doing, which basically harkens back to popularizing a dish that is very Quebecois, have you heard anything from either the tourism department here or the Quebec government about your efforts, or have you gotten in contact with them and let them know what you're doing?
I have gotten in contact with them, not so much with tourism, but directly here in Europe with the various different consulates. And each country has a consulate that specifically deals with agri-food, agriculture, Canada. And it's been difficult. They don't have much of a budget to promote Canadian foods. I was invited once to the embassy in Vienna, which is a large embassy, and we did a poutine event with the ambassador's private chef there with Great Gravies. And it's been tough. I get some of the individuals there that say they love it and they try and help me promote it amongst their friends. But in terms of actual government support along those lines, really nothing at all. Same with the Quebec missions here. There's a Quebec mission actually directly in Munich. I think Paris and Munich are the only two in Montreal. And I get individual employees there that will come by to our parties and our events. but haven't been able to get any official help from them yet.
Well, you certainly are bringing a little piece of Quebec to Europe. As far as the app is concerned, how can people find that again?
People that are on Facebook, if they go to and put in Poutine A, spelled E-H, as in the Canadian A, and then Addictive App Game, they should be able to find it there. Or you kindly let me post a link to it on the Stuff File Facebook page. So if they can go there, they could like it, and they can keep up to date there. We just launched the information 2 days ago, and we'll be keeping people appraised. And there's an opportunity for somebody who wants to fund it, do partial funding, to have a caricature done of themselves as one of the characters in the game. And there's all sorts of fun things that we're going to be doing.
Excellent. Well, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us, and continued success with bringing Poutine to the world.
Well, I thank you very much. And hopefully we'll be talking about this again sometime soon, once it's up and running and becomes the top-selling app in Canada.
Well, much success to you in that regard. Jochen Esquelant, who sells Poutine in Munich, Germany. Now, you can check out the website at mpoutine.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0178. And you'll find that link, plus the Facebook link to the Poutine app.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk relationships with relationship coach Frank Kermit. Plus, Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter. He'll review a couple of books for us, as usual. And, of course, there is indeed an Idiot of the Day coming your way. But right now we have more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, just because the town is called Niceville doesn't mean they'll patiently wait for your mom to pick you up after you tried to rob the local convenience store. 22-year-old Zachariah Dalton Howard is charged with attempting to rob a Thumbs Up convenience store in the Florida town when he told the clerk he had a gun. But he left the store without any cash after the clerk showed him the empty cash register. Howard then walked over to a nearby Winn-Dixie store where he called his mom and asked for a ride home. According to the report, Howard told police that he had initially left his mom's home to, quote, let off some steam, unquote, and didn't set out to rob the Thumbs Up, but came up with the idea while he was walking. Yeah. As authorities deemed Howard did not, in fact, bring a gun into the store, he was formally charged with attempted robbery without a weapon. Came up with the idea while he was walking, huh? Hopefully he also didn't try to chew gum at the same time. Okay, updating the smell of napalm in the morning kind of phrase. A cosmetic company in Gaza recently began selling a fragrance dedicated to victory over Israel and named after the signature M75 missile that Hamas has been firing across the border. This is a quote. "The fragrance is pleasant and attractive," said the company owner, "like the missiles of the Palestinian resistance, and comes in masculine and feminine varieties at premium prices, over presumably the prices of ordinary Gazan fragrances. Sympathizers can splash on victory," he said, "from anywhere in the world." Wow. Didn't someone once say war stinks? Anyway, Anthony Johnson, age 49, was convicted in October in Hartford, Connecticut, of stealing an improbably large amount of money, as much as $70,000 a weekend, off and on for 5 years, by crawling on the floor of darkened theaters and lifting credit cards from purses that movie-watching women had set down. Now, the FBI said Johnson was careful to pick films likely to engross female viewers so that he could operate freely. He was often able to finish up, leave the theater, and make cash advance withdrawals from ATMs before the movie had ended. Okay, now, I don't know how he got the PIN numbers, unless these people are, you know, writing their PIN numbers on the back of their cards, which is a silly thing to do. But anyway, I'm glad he's been caught, and I hope he's locked up for a very, very long time. But on the other hand, as far as criminals go, that's ingenious. I mean, well thought out. Kudos for style points, if anything else. But, you know, lock him up. Moving right along, two alleged thieves in Australia have been arrested after tunneling into a KFC rather than a jewelry store in a heist gone badly wrong. The men, Peter Walsh, age 32, and Dwayne Doolin, age 31, allegedly tried to make the best of their mistake and staged an impromptu holdup at the fast food restaurant in the town of Beaudesert, which is southwest of Brisbane. They escaped with $2,600 after threatening staff with a metal bar in the New Year's Eve robbery, but were then arrested and charged after a raid on Welsh's home. The pair of thieves were making their third attempt to rob the jewelers. They had previously attempted to smash through the front window, and when that attempt failed, they then tried to get in through the back doors, but instead found themselves in the neighboring Animal Welfare League opportunity shop. On that occasion, they again tried to make the most of their situation, allegedly stealing a charity box containing $50. In their latest attempt to target the jewelers, the pair broke into a bathroom block at the rear of the line of shops and used an iron bar to make a hole in the wall. When they crawled through the hole, they found themselves surrounded by chicken nuggets rather than diamonds. Police prosecutor Sergeant Damien Summerfield said at Southport Magistrates Court that they then threatened staff with the iron bar. One female staffer opened the safe and they grabbed lots of cash, he said. Welsh is charged with armed robbery, stealing, burglary, and attempted burglary, while Doolin is charged with robbery and stealing. Wow. Trying on three separate occasions to break into a jewelry store with no success? At least you can say they were persistent. Not smart, but persistent. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, buying a birthday present for your mom may be a nice sentiment, but it's no excuse for a robbery. Authorities in eastern Pennsylvania say a teenager has admitted to robbing a gas station so he could buy his mom a gift. 18-year-old Cameron Christian Blake has pleaded guilty to felony robbery. According to court records, Blake told police he got $130 and dropped $82 on a Kindle Fire e-reader for his mother. He spent the rest on pot, by the way. He is being sentenced later this month for that and another armed robbery back in September. Oh, his mother must be so proud. So proud. Moving right along to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Relationship coach Frank Kermit is a best-selling author, educator, and relationship columnist. He also presents sex talks at such events as the upcoming Everything to Do with Sex show at Place Bonaventure later this month in Montreal, and also the Salon de Marier at the Palais de Congrès in February. Frank is here now to talk about relationships, and he joins us on the line via Skype to Skype communications. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Nice to have you on the program with us. Now, you talk about various things when you do these discussions, and including something called couples in transition. What exactly does that mean?
Couples in transition refers to when a couple is making a significant change to their status. Now, this can include a number of things. It can include things like the empty nest syndrome, where the children are grown and the couple, once again, is alone. This can include a different stage where some of their children are old enough to be going to school. They no longer have an infant in diapers, and they're reconnecting again as man and wife when, for a long time, they were mom and dad. This can also include when one person in the couple is interested in going back for an education and changing a career path. That's also a form of transition. It also includes when couples decide that they want to augment their sex life and make a change to their status related to monogamy or non-monogamy.
Okay. Now, some of the things, and you also do discussions, for instance, at the Salon de Marier that's coming up in February, I understand you'd be talking or giving pre-marriage talks. And there are certain questions, which I find rather interesting, certain questions to ask your fiancé before you get married. Now, I think a lot of those questions would be obvious to some folks, but some of them perhaps not so obvious.
Exactly. When I'm at the Salon de la Mariée and people come up to my booth, I'll be asking them questions like, have you talked to your fiancé about who should and should not be invited to the wedding? For example, does your fiancé know everybody who's coming to the wedding that has already seen you naked? I know this sounds like a very silly question, but I have been to weddings where this has happened, and I have counseled couples where this has happened, where somebody came to the wedding that was actually an ex-lover, usually a secret ex-lover of either the bride or the groom. And when does this come out? It comes out at the reception. And it spoils the entire experience for one or both of that couple.
Well, this goes back to one of my earlier questions, and that is everything or should everything be on the table? Should someone who is getting married explicitly give details to their previous love life, for instance?
Absolutely. In my opinion, we live in a digital age now. Everybody's past can be put out there for everyone else to see. And at the very least, if you're going to marry somebody, they should have the ability to handle whatever information comes their way. And I can tell you this as a coach and as someone who works with these couples. It's not the information itself. It's the fact that it was kept from them. Now the big question is, well, what else are you hiding from me? What else am I going to be embarrassed about or surprised about? When the person knows about their partner's past and that past comes to light, well, I already knew about it and I chose to accept it then. I can deal with it now.
Okay, so we're talking about supposedly normal, rational people here, adults communicating about their past relationships. But what about someone who... It's not the keeping of the secret. It's the information that they can't get past. What happens in a relationship there?
Look, if you cannot accept your partner completely and totally, it's better not to get married. And here is where we have the dilemma. People are afraid to communicate because of that fear of conflict. They're petrified that they're going to be abandoned. And this is very understandable. You want to spend the rest of your life with somebody. You've met somebody. You're in love. You see a future with them, but now you're worried. But if I tell my partner the truth, they may leave. Well, that's why you need to tell them the truth. That's why you need to sit down and say, here are all the reasons why you should not marry me. And if they stick around after that, okay, you are building a foundation that nobody else can put cracks in. But if you start with secrets, all you're doing is creating a foundation that other people have the power to jab and crack.
We live, particularly here in Canada, in a very multicultural society. So many people, so many different groups make up the melting pot that is the Canadian panorama. And I think some people would be very surprised to know that within certain groups in this country, there are still a lot of arranged marriages where, in some cases, the bride doesn't know the groom before they get married when their family puts them together. I just wanted to bring that one up because we talk nowadays more and more about communication, 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 yet there are still lots of people who are getting married who don't really know each other.
I got to tell you that the divorce rate for arranged marriages is still about the same as the divorce rate for people who go into the marriage having been in a relationship for some time. You have to remember, being in a long-term relationship requires a certain set of skills. These are communication skills and managing expectations. You have to have realistic expectations as to what a long-term relationship can offer. If you go into a relationship with misguided expectations, you're going to be unhappy. You're going to be miserable. And if you go into a long-term relationship with horrible relationship skills, being unable to manage intense emotion, for example, having any sort of insecurities that are taking to an extreme level where you are now just so flustered and you're starting to play out things in your own brain that will never actually happen in reality, these are the things that can detract from a relationship. So bear in mind that there's nothing wrong with a prearranged marriage as long as both parties are consenting. What we're looking at, do we have compatible values? Do we have realistic expectations? And sometimes a prearranged marriage usually is based on cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds. There are social norms in place which answer those questions. You know what to expect because you're being set up into a situation where both of you have pre-designated gender roles. Now, what happens in a society that has removed the social norms and told people you can have any relationship you want, you can structure any relationship you want, without some basic skills as to how to manage intense emotions and how to keep your expectations realistic, that's just a formula for failure.
Now, as far as the expectations of parties coming into a relationship, does it differ if, say, one of the two members of the new relationship was previously married, or if both of the people in a relationship were previously married?
Usually, if you have a failed marriage in the past, the big question to ask is, what did you learn about yourself? If the person says, well, I learned that I married the wrong person, that doesn't really tell me that they've really figured out who they are and can they communicate those things about themselves that maybe would turn off a potential partner. Usually, people will say that in their first marriage failing, they'll blame the other person. It's when their second marriage fails that they say, well, maybe there's a problem with me. And by the time they get to the third relationship and they start noticing the same problems, that's usually when people get up and say, okay, now I'm going to seek out the help of a professional. I can't keep doing this. But by that point, you've got a couple of failed marriages in your background. I like helping people before they get married and start asking them really hard questions that they maybe have never thought about.
Now, going back to one of the shows you're going to be doing, the one at Place Bonaventure, the Everything to Do with Sex show, is it a situation when you do these type of programs that people are initially skittish to open up and discuss sex?
Yes, sometimes that is the case. Usually, it's not the topic of sex, but whether or not the person coming to me feels a sense of trust. And because I work primarily as a coach and a natural therapist, I can share personal stories from my background. And through that, I gain a rapport with the client. That's when they feel they can trust me because they are more comfortable opening up to me since I'm just as open with them. And that's the key.
And I guess also there's the skittishness that some people have because they wonder if whatever they do and or think when it comes to sex, if it's supposedly, and I'm doing air quotes here, in the realm of normal as opposed to the general population.
Everybody is afraid of being stigmatized. And in some cases, some people are afraid to talk to their partners about what they might like to try. They're worried about their partner judging them. They're worried about their partner leaving them. That's understandable. There's a lot on the line here. If you haven't talked about these things beforehand, and now you've got a marriage, possibly some children on the line, you have a mortgage together, you're building a future together, but there's that one thing that's been on your mind, that curiosity is starting to get to you, and you aren't really sure if you could be completely honest with your partner. And I got to tell you, in almost every case that I've ever dealt with, it hasn't been the request itself that has really caused the problem. It has been the way it was presented. Because once it's presented in a way that makes your partner feel reassured that this is not to replace your partner, but something to enjoy with your partner, then you can open up the dialogue. But so many people are afraid to take that step.
Interesting topic indeed. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is well-named Frank Talks, correct?
That's correct. FrankTalks.com.
FrankTalks.com. And I'm sure you'll find, people will find their information about the places that you're going to be appearing, such as at the Salon de la Mariée in February, and also the other event, the Everything to Do with Sex show coming up at Place Bonaventure in, later this month.
That's right. In Montreal, it's called the Salon de l'Amour et Séduction. That's happening at Place Bonaventure. The Salon de la Mariée, which is done by Sheldon Kagan, the big bridal show that's now in its 30-some-odd year of production. That's happening at Palais de Congrès. It's going to be great. I'm so thrilled to have a chance to participate and help people with their problems.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Thank you, Peter. This has been outstanding. You are my first interview of the new year.
It's always good to be somebody's first. Relationship coach, Frank Kermit. You can check out his website at franktalks.com to find out more about his upcoming events. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0178, and you'll find the link to his site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Chrissy DeSopo loves to garden, and she's good at it. So good that her gardens have been featured in magazines like Better Homes and Gardens. 20 years ago, the Connecticut woman decided to open her gardens for tours to raise money for local charities. The tours became so popular that she's been able to raise nearly $200,000 for a variety of charities. But last summer, a woman on the tour tripped on a brick walkway, hurt her ankle, and filed a claim for her injury. Then the woman's husband threatened to sue for his own pain and suffering that he claimed was linked to his wife's ankle. DeSopo, who makes a living as a painter, said that's when she realized she could lose her home because of a lawsuit. So, reluctantly, she decided to close her garden to tours. Let's be fair. Excessive litigation in America affects many more people than just those who are directly sued. It affects charities, community groups, and many others, too. Find out how we're all affected. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And when we last left our hero, he was talking about a book about books. That was 2 weeks ago. What, oh what, will Stuart Nauman be talking about today? Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And we're going to talk about a book, not Desi Arnaz's autobiography, which is called A Book, believe it or not. And a pretty good one, too. But, all right, Peter, I'll spill the beans. It's another book about books.
Really?
Yeah.
What's this book called?
It's called My Ideal Bookshelf.
Is this a book you find at IKEA?
No, but maybe you should, actually. But it's written in English, not Swedish.
Okay, good. Yeah, I was worried.
But you may have an idea there. That's not bad. But as an avid reader, like myself, oh, surprise, surprise, and bookworm, yes, that too, I like to display with pride the books that I have read and savored throughout my life on a network of bookshelves and bookcases, and I have quite a few of them in my place. And in turn, whenever I visit someone's home, I like to take a look at their bookshelves to see what displayed tomes that they have in their bookshelves that they've read in the past. Now, basically, a well-stocked and well-displayed bookshelf is not only a means to store your books, but also a means of self-identity based on the type of books you have read all, you know, for all the world or your friends and guests to see. Now, writer-editor Thessaly LaForce and artist-illustrator Jane Mount has taken the bookworm's curiosity of peeking at someone else's bookshelf and has created an interesting concept for a coffee table book called My Ideal Bookshelf. You know, maybe it should come with, you know, a do-it-yourself bookshelf. Like I said, IKEA, good cross-promotion.
Yep.
Now, what they did was they asked over 100 American creative and cultural personalities, such as writers, designers, musicians, editors, photographers, illustrators, and chefs, about the books that would make up their ideal bookshelf. Now, the chosen books had to have an impact on them on a personal or professional level and help them on the path of gaining knowledge or towards, you know, helping them with their respective professions. Like, for example, producer Judd Apatow confessed that reading Albert Goldman's biography, Ladies and Gentlemen, Lenny Bruce, which he used for a grade 8 book report, that's really advanced thinking there, sparked his interest in pursuing a career in comedy. And author Stephanie Meyer admits that reading Anne of Green Gables, the whole series of Anne of Green Gables books, influenced her when she wrote her best-selling series of Twilight novels. So that's pretty interesting, actually. Now, the other ingredient that makes My Ideal Bookshelf such a delight for the bibliophile is the paintings by Jane Mount that accompany each profile. She colorfully recreates the bookshelves by faithfully reproducing the spines of the chosen books based on the original cover artwork and all their aesthetic glory. And I love seeing such original artwork from such classics as All the King's Men, East of Eden, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and The Grapes of Wrath. And for those readers who get inspired to compile their own ideal bookshelf, there's a blank form at the back of the book which is available for you to complete and send to Mount and LaForce that will be posted on their own blog. In fact, I submitted my own one. In fact, one sheet wasn't enough because it's only good for 10 books. So I submitted two sheets, actually. And even have their own website, which is www.idealbookshelf.com, where you could even have Miss Mount do a customized ideal bookshelf painting that could contain between 7 and 20 chosen titles. For me, she may have to use two canvases, I guess. Yeah. So My Ideal Bookshelf is an interesting new way to appreciate good books and books that you normally wouldn't hear about but would encourage you to read and discover on your own, actually. And I did send them two sheets in the back. Well, one sheet, I made two of them, of what My Ideal Bookshelf would look like, actually.
And what does your ideal book? You know, it's funny because 2 weeks ago I asked you what would be the last book you'd read if you knew you were going to die.
Right.
So now I guess I'm asking you, what is your ideal bookshelf?
Well, I'll just give you a few samples because, I mean, we don't have time to, you know, say all 20. But, for example, obviously Groucho and Me.
Right.
Harpo Speaks, his autobiography. Charlie right. Chaplin's my autobiography. Mm-hmm. All the President's Men. Exodus by Leon Uris. The Help by Catherine Stockett. I, the Dream by Mickey Spillane. To Kill a Mockingbird, Catcher in the Rye, Death of a Salesman, Shogun by James Clavell. The Best of Life, which was the first coffee table book dealing with the history of life magazine. Loved it. And even a couple of Pierre Burton books, National Dream and The Last Spike.
Is there room when you put a Pierre Burton book on your shelf?
Well, that's why I have to use two sheets.
Okay. You know, it's funny because I think I heard you mention two that I would have. You mentioned Death of a Salesman.
Yeah.
And you mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those would be on my list. I would probably put, different times of my life, Charlotte's Web.
Mm hmm.
I would put an odd selection, The Breast by Philip Roth. Have you ever read that book?
No, but I've heard of it.
That is just so weird. Just so weird. I put that on. Two of David Niven's books, Bring on the Empty Horses and The Moon's a Balloon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I even put Ball Four by Jim Bouton. I had a baseball book in there, too.
Yes, and Nice Guys Finish Last.
You know what? I think maybe you should submit your ideal bookshelf to these two. They have a blog and they do post people's submissions. So it wouldn't be a bad idea, Peter.
And I've got to toss in my favorite biography or autobiography, which segues into something I want to mention anyway.
Okay.
The Ragman's Son by Kirk Douglas is my favorite autobiography. And I'm currently reading his most recent book, which is I Am Spartacus, which talks about making that movie and the trouble he had making that movie in dealing with the blacklist and in hiring the writer and the director. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, great movie.
But a great story behind the movie too. And when you consider that the person who wrote the book that the movie was on basically wrote it while he was in jail.
Yeah, wasn't he Howard Fast blacklisted also?
Exactly, one of the 10. Yeah.
Amazing.
Fascinating stuff.
Anyway, oh, it certainly is. It's a great way, almost like the book lovers water cooler discussion type of subject.
Absolutely. So this sounds like a great idea for a book. Again, this one is called what?
It's called My Ideal Bookshelf by Jane Mount and Thessaly LaForest. It's published by Little Brown, and it's $27.99.
Did you say Thessaly LaForest?
Thessaly LaForest.
LaForest. I hear that name, and in my head, I see some sort of foppish character played by Harvey Korman, like Hedley Lamarr.
Oh, no. I see your picture here in the end flap. Far from foppish.
Okay. Anyway, and it's published by whom?
Little Brown, and it's $27.99.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, if I'm not perusing other people's bookshelves or my own, I'm weekly in the West End Times every Saturday, in print or online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
This is the Stuff File.
And we're just about at a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day, but I have a couple more Stuff File stories to share with you first. A man who was mauled after leaping into a Siberian tiger's den at the Bronx Zoo in September pleaded not guilty to criminal trespassing charges. David Villalobos, age 25, jumped off of the zoo's elevated monorail and into the tiger enclosure on the afternoon of September 21st. He was released until his next court appearance on March 12th. Villalobos said he jumped into the tiger's den for spiritual reasons. "I was testing my natural fear," he said. "I wanted to be at one with the tiger." Yeah. During his 10 minutes with the 400-pound Siberian tiger named Bushuta, he sustained multiple bites or puncture wounds on his arms, legs, and shoulder. The zoo's emergency workers rescued him by scaring the tiger away with a fire extinguisher. Spiritual reasons, huh? He wanted to be at one with the tiger and test his natural fear. Well then, if he's convicted, I wonder how fearful he would be being at one with a cellmate named Bubba. How spiritual would that be? Authorities say a Florida panhandle man has been arrested after he tried to rob a convenience store with a cattle prod, but was thwarted by a clerk with a gun. The Leon County Sheriff's Office says 26-year-old Lance Tomberlin went into a store just outside Tallahassee on January 2nd, produced a cattle prod, and demanded money from the clerk. Officials say he shot the clerk several times before the clerk pulled a handgun. Tomberlin fled, and another employee tried to restrain him, but he eventually escaped in his truck. Deputies stopped Tomberlin's truck, but he fled on foot. He was later arrested, 2 days later, actually, and charged with armed robbery and aggravated battery. Oh, it's stories like this that play right into the hands of the NRA, isn't it? Yeah. And by the way, it's no way to get a date. Jason Earl Dean is going to prison after he handcuffed himself to a female Taco Bell co-worker. Dean said he was trying to convince the young woman to go out with him. A Georgia judge has sentenced Dean to 4 years in the slammer. He'll also have to do 6 years of probation. Gee, do you think she'll wait for him? No, I don't think so. You know, I almost made him the idiot of the day because that's a pretty stupid thing to do, but he's not. But this next person is this week's idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
A 21-year-old former student of Ellsbury High School has been arrested after he allegedly called a school and threatened to blow it up. Sean Brian Neighbor Jr. from Bell, Missouri, was charged with making a terrorist threat. School Superintendent Dr. Tim Reller called the Lincoln County Sheriff's Department regarding a message left on the school's answering machine. Authorities contacted AT&T and traced the call back to Neighbor's cell phone. Yeah. He was taken in for questioning and admitted to making the call. School, by the way, was not disrupted because of the threat. Now, why would someone at the age of 21, supposedly a grown man, years removed from high school, call his former school from his own cell phone to call in a bomb threat? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0178. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0178. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCore in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.